I found the record at a thrift shop not that long ago. I think it was the 70s style cover art that caught my eye, with the likeness of an old man in a flannel shirt and a ball cap, staring off into the distance with a cloud of smoke rising behind him. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and the guy in the picture is folk hero, contrarian, and human country song Harry R. Truman.
Listen to the story of a man called Harry Truman, who lived his life upon the mountainside.
This Harry Truman, not to be confused with the U.S. president, was the owner of a lodge on Spirit Lake near the foot of Mount St. Helens. His story became a legend almost instantly. The record is called Your Spirit Lives On, The Musical Legend of Harry Truman. It came out in 1981. The songs tell and embellish the tale of Truman stubbornly refusing to leave his lodge, even as friends and scientists and government types warned him that the mountain was about to blow. As he famously said, that mountain and that lake are a part of Truman, and I'm a part of it. Harry R. Truman was an anti-hero of the American West right out of Central Casting. His colorful language, his ever-present whiskey and coke, his middle finger to authority. And here's something I hadn't really realized, having transplanted to the Northwest about 3 decades after the eruption. Truman didn't become a folk hero when he died. He was already famous by then. For months, news teams there to report on the volcano's rumblings would visit Truman. He'd oblige them with invective, and then they would spread the folklore across the world.
Give 'em hell, Harry, we're all right behind you. Don't let them push you around. It's your mountain, you can stay if you want to. Don't have to come down.
Historian Richard Slatta wrote that Truman's death, quote, immortalized him as a figure with many of the embellished qualities of the Western hero, and that those were, quote, in some ways quite different from his true character. So, Paul Bunyan isn't real. John Henry never sat down with a Japanese news crew, and you can't hear Davy Crockett's voice on YouTube. We can have their legends and not worry about the messy fact of their humanity. But Truman is all there in the flesh, along with his beloved cats.
I tell them if they don't like my apples, don't shake my tree.
The press has blown it up. They have blown it out of all proportion.
Can't hardly make it, honey. The old broken down man, but I'm taking pills.
Spirit Lake and Mount St. Helens is my life, folks. I've lived there 50 years. It's a part of me.
Richard Slatta, the historian, summed it up this way. To some, he was nothing more than a crusty codger. So I, for one, am a little bit torn about celebrating this guy. On the one hand, what he did was self-destructive and blockheaded and probably killed the 16 cats that he supposedly loved so much. And yet, it was only by being at the wrong place at the wrong time that Harry Truman became the fullest version of himself.
If you look high on the mountain, you can see him in the garden, and through the lonesome when you hear him say.
Today on the show, our theme is Wrong Place, Wrong Time. Stories of people stuck in circumstances they can't control, and what's revealed by the choices they make. Our next story of being in the wrong place at the wrong time is about a young scientist. This person was brilliant and ambitious and would go on to bring hope to a whole bunch of people who had been condemned to a life of suffering and isolation. But today our hero is barely remembered, maybe because she was a she and African American, and the year was 1916. Paul Wurmager first got wind of the story when he was working at a research library. He's retired now from the University of Hawaii.
It was a serendipitous thing. I was working at the Science and Technology Reference Desk, and somebody came and asked a simple question, do you know if there is a Chamugra tree growing on campus?
That tree, the Chamugra tree, was central to a discovery that now seems obscure, but at the time was a huge deal. And the person who made it was Alice Augusta Ball. Ball grew up in Seattle's Central District. Her grandfather was an early photographer, one of the few black experts at a technique called daguerreotype. Paul Wurmager imagines that awakened Alice's interest in chemistry.
I think as a child, can you imagine seeing a piece of paper being submerged into a liquid and then all of a sudden out of it comes a picture? I think it was very unique and it made her very unique.
She would go on to study pharmacy at the University of Washington and showed huge promise.
She actually got two articles co-published before she even got her master's degree in the most prestigious chemistry journal in the world. So that struck me as, wow, this person is pretty amazing.
Alice Ball headed to what was then called the College of Hawaii for graduate school, destined to encounter that Chalmugra tree. The thing that brought tree and chemist together was leprosy.
It was considered a death sentence. Not only that, but then you were taken away from your family. And in Hawaiian and Polynesian and Asian, family is the most important thing. Once you lose that, you're kind of, well, you're dead in some ways.
It, of course, is biblical in its conception.
That's James Harnish of Harborview Medical Center in Seattle.
The stigma with the almost terrifying skin and facial disformities. So all of that tends to make somebody with leprosy an outcast.
Harnish runs Harborview's Hansen's Disease Clinic. Hansen's disease is another name for leprosy, which Harnish has been treating for a half a century. He says that for most of history, people with this disease were simply isolated and left to die.
There was no treatment at that point in time at all, so it was a matter of just offering care while you're watching the disease progress to destroy the face, destroy the hands, the arms. It was a very sad situation.
There was one folk remedy for leprosy, though it wasn't super effective, oil extracted from the seeds of a tropical Asian tree called Chalmugra. But using Chalmugra oil had drawbacks.
People were applying it both to the lesions as a salve as well as injecting it in an oil-based preparation. The injections were extraordinarily painful, but it was observed that people who used Chalmugra oil actually showed some benefit.
So the challenge was this, to come up with an extract of the oil's active ingredients that could be mixed in water and injected without pain. A local surgeon in Hawaii took up the problem, and he contacted Alice Ball for help. It's hard to understate how daunting that assignment was. Alice Ball was just 24 years old and fresh out of undergrad, for one thing. And of course, this was 1916. There were no modern centrifuges or gas chromatography. But there was a brand new, still obscure method being developed in Europe, and Alice Ball found out about it.
People were struggling just with, what do you do with this oil that if you let it set, it just hardens into like lard. But using alcohol, you make it into what's called an ethyl ester. Then it becomes water soluble. And that was the breakthrough that she made.
It was the first practical injectable extract of Chalmugra oil. And for the first time in human history, there was a dependable, effective treatment for this feared and ancient disease.
The people who did finally get the injections did show remarkable improvements. I found photographs, and they're just startling. The person looks like really a different person.
Now, Chalmugra oil was not a cure. That would come later with new drugs in the 1940s. But James Harnish says it gave a group of doomed people hope for the first time.
You have to understand, she was doing this before women had a right to vote. This is amazing. And again, she was an African-American woman. Phenomenal that she could get this far.
So where is Alice Ball in the firmament of pioneering scientists? Where's the statue and the biopic and the endowed chair of chemistry or whatever? Well, that would have been a great question to ask Arthur Dean. He was president of the College of Hawaii, and he took up Alice Ball's work. The thing is, people assumed it was Dean, the white man, who had the breakthrough. And he accepted the credit that should have gone to the black female prodigy.
So then his name became attached to this breakthrough with Chalmugra, and people forgot about Alice.
And it gets worse. This should have been just the opening to a brilliant scientific career for Alice Ball. Instead, just months later, at age 24, she had an accident in the classroom.
Well, according to the newspaper recounts, two of them say that she was demonstrating some experiment in class and got poisoned by chlorine gas.
Alice Ball died before she could watch her research transform so many lives and without getting proper credit. It wasn't until the last couple of decades that her name has resurfaced, thanks partly to Paul Wurmacher of the University of Hawaii. He nudged the university to honor Ball, and he personally established a scholarship in her name. These days, he's retired, but still working busily to write Alice Ball's biography.
I never, ever had a sister when I grew up, and I always kind of wanted a sister. So I have kind of adopted her as my sister. And I only want the very best for her because she was so ignored, which is, you know, that's a wrong.
For its part, the University of Washington has not memorialized this extraordinary alumna, besides one UW employee planning her own gift in Alice's name to fund women of color junior faculty. But in the summer of 2019, Alice Ball did get a measure of recognition in Seattle.
At the age of 23, she discovered what is now known as the Ball Method after isolating the ethyl esters.
This is third grader Jessie Balnick. According to her mom, Jamie Clausen, Jessie learned about Alice Ball in a book called Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls 2. She created this video and launched a campaign to convince the Seattle Parks Department to name a small park after Alice Ball.
There is a new park opening up next to the Greenwood Library. It's a park where kids and their families can come to read and learn from the books they check out. We think it would be wonderful if that park could be named after Alice Ball so kids could remember that learning can change lives and that learning can look like all of us.
The push succeeded. Alice Augusta Ball is now the namesake of a park in the city she was born in. It's taken 100 years, but this pioneering black woman chemist is finally taking her place in the history of science and in bedtime stories for rebel girls everywhere. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today's theme is Wrong Place, Wrong Time. For Eric Bishop, that time was a Thursday morning in September of 2015, and the place was behind the steering wheel of a duck boat headed north on the Aurora Bridge in Seattle. 36 tourists were riding behind him. They were listening to Sinatra.
Come fly with me, let's fly away.
Everything that morning was routine, including the song. Bishop liked to play this tune as he drove across the bridge. He was a trained pilot, and he said that being up that high reminded him of flying.
Let's fly, let's fly away.
Another routine part of that day, the safety inspection. With his pilot background, Bishop says his inspections were incredibly thorough. He went over and under and through the duck, touching every part he could see to make sure it was safe for travel. What he didn't know at the time was that there was one part, a part hidden away in an axle casing that was defective. And at the moment that he and Sinatra and 36 souls were crossing that bridge, it was about to break.
Stunning images and a staggering casualty count.
It was just mass destruction.
Tonight, the NTSB has arrived in Seattle, looking into what caused this duck boat to hit a charter bus.
It all began when Bishop heard a strange noise.
The duck made a clunk clunk, and I thought that was kind of weird. And she gently just veered off to the right. Okay, so I very gently tried to nudge her back. And the steering wheel felt like it was in jello. I mean, it was just, there was nothing there. And then she did the hard, uncommanded left turn. And as soon as that thing started to veer, I hit the brakes. And I had hands on the steering wheel, trying to pull that thing back into the northbound lanes again. For all I was worth, that steering wheel felt like it was welded. It did not move. I remember hearing the tires skidding, locked up. And then there it was. I looked up and I saw a black and white wall, and that was the impact. I remember hearing the crash, And then I was face down over the steering wheel. I had one of the passengers right behind me. She flew up, and what she did is she basically pinned me against the steering wheel. And I looked over my shoulder, my right shoulder, and I said, are you okay? And she said, yes. I said, would you please get off me? And she slid off, and I got up, unbuckled my seatbelt, and turned around, and I looked, and that's when I saw hell. I undid my seatbelt, I stood up, and I just started to assess who's hurt, who's conscious, who's mobile, who's not. And I said, anybody who's ambulatory, anybody can go, please leave now. And then one guy said, I can go, but I said, I've got a woman, and she's unconscious, and her head is on my foot, and she was kind of like buried underneath the seat. And I said, do not move your foot. Just stay put. Don't move her neck. And we got the rest of the people who could move off, and by then the fire department showed up. One of the captains came on board, and he said, it's time, you know, he said, you got to get off this dock. And I said, I'm responsible for this vehicle. I said, I will turn control over to you. Your responsibility. He said, it is my responsibility. He said, it's your dock. And then I left. I got down onto the road deck, and it was chaos. It was total chaos. Another captain came over, and he said, you need to get out of here. You need help. And I refused. And he says, all right, fine. Sit down here. I'm going to get a towel for your face. And apparently, it looked like I went through a cheese grater. I was bleeding everywhere, and I didn't know it. All I knew was, you know, something bad had gone on. I'm hurting, but I can still help people. We had a yellow tarp and a red tarp. Red tarp was not good. Yellow tarp, people were hurt. And then beside that, we had people that were mobile enough that they could walk around. And I was taking people, they say, take them over to yellow or take them over up against the Jersey barrier. And I would walk people over to where they needed to be to get aid. Finally, after I did what I could, one of the captains said, Eric said, you have to leave. This is the last ambulance here. You've got to go. And so they put me in an ambulance, and we headed north up to, don't remember what it was called, but I was in the ICU for several days. They told me that there were fatalities. When I got to the hospital, they said there's two fatalities. They took me into a room while they're waiting to get me underneath a CAT scan. And then they came in and said, another one. And then another one. And then finally, it was like a, I don't know, 24 hours later, the fifth one perished. And, I mean, I will go to my grave with those five people and their families. Every time I see a bus, or especially a coach, I flash back. A semi can pass me. It's white, and underneath it's dark. I flash. It still goes. I still have the nightmares. Five people always die.
In your dream?
Yes.
Did you ever think that there was anything that you could have done differently to get a different outcome?
I've gone through that scenario so many times. There was nothing I could have done differently. Not a thing. If it didn't happen and it was going to happen today, I would have done nothing different. It would have been the same routine. There was nothing I could have done to avoid that situation.
Are there elements of it that you kind of focus on or dwell on that, you know, if they had been different, the outcome would have been different?
Absolutely. Those five souls saved 37 souls that day.
Well, what do you mean by that?
That bus wasn't there, we would have gone off the side of the bridge. I wouldn't be having this conversation with you. Those five souls saved our lives.
And you have no doubt in your mind about that?
No doubt. The way the duck has the hull, we would hit that Jersey barrier and we'd gone right over the top of it like it wasn't even there.
So that's a tricky thing to think about, right? Like, what if, but then there's still five innocent people who lost their lives? I mean, that's another one. How do you hold both those things?
You can't. I'm not justifying it.
Yeah.
Not at all. I wish the hell this whole thing never happened in the first place. If I could wind back time, oh yeah. But thinking about it, they did. Those five souls and those injured on the bus saved 37 souls on that dock. I wouldn't be here. We would have gone right over the edge.
Yeah. Well, Eric Bishop works in customer service for a Seattle area company. He was the driver of the duck boat that had that fatal crash on the Aurora Bridge several years ago. You can read the NTSB investigative documents on our website at knkxsoundeffect.org. And Eric, thank you again for telling your story.
Thank you, Gabriel.
Let's fly. Some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come fly with me, let's fly away.
This is Sound Effect from KNKX. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is Wrong Place, Wrong Time. There's never a good time to get evicted or to be low on cash. But when that happens late in life to a senior citizen, it can be enough to push a person into homelessness. It's become a major problem in Western Washington, where housing costs have spiked, and many older people are finding it hard to adapt. Sound Effect's Jennifer Wing spent some time with a social worker who's working to keep her elderly clients from being homeless for the first time in their lives.
A man with salt-and-pepper hair and a clean-shaven face shuffles into an office inside the Wallingford Senior Center in North Seattle. His name is Terry Parkhurst. He's 69 years old, and he's here to get help and support from a social worker named Denise Malm.
What we should probably focus on today, Terry, is housing.
Housing.
Okay. Right? And so, have you heard anything from Four Freedoms?
No, I haven't.
Four Freedoms is an apartment building for seniors that has some low-income units.
And then also, with the Seattle Housing Authority, are you calling each month to maintain your spot on the waiting list?
Yes.
Great.
Terry's current housing situation is precarious at best. He's been in the same apartment near Northgate for the last 13 years. When he first moved in, he was working as a writer. His area of interest is the auto industry. Terry's work has been published in trade magazines and even the New York Times. But over the last few years, he hasn't been able to work because of his health.
There are times literally getting out of bed is difficult.
Terry has symptoms of Parkinson's, a slight tremor, a slow walk, slowed speech, but he hasn't been officially diagnosed. Every last cent that comes into his bank account goes to paying the rent for his one-bedroom apartment, which has steadily increased over the years. Every month he runs a deficit. He dips into his savings to cover the gaps, and he has a SNAP card for food. Terry knows that his situation is not sustainable.
I'd be dishonest if I didn't say I'm somewhat anxious and living with fear. When I write that rent check now every month, I'm just amazed I'm writing a check for that amount of money. And if I had to move, like, next month, I don't know where I'd go.
Yeah, the whole idea of possibly being homeless at this stage in your life, has that been a thought that has entered your mind?
Yes, it has. It's given me some sense of empathy with the people that are homeless that I never had before. But it's mind-boggling to think about being homeless at this age in my life. I don't know that I'll make it, but I think I will.
A pile of paperwork is spread out on Denise Malm's desk. These are Terry's applications for low-income senior housing.
So this needs to be filled out. This paperwork can be daunting. Navigating it will blow your mind. I have a hard time. I cannot imagine an older adult trying to figure out all the resources and the different systems. I'll put together an envelope for you to keep the stuff in so you can keep it all in one place.
At the end of his meeting with Denise, Terry asks her a question.
How typical do you feel my experience with these matters are?
Oh, Terry, this is so much of what I'm doing now. It wasn't like this probably about 3 years ago, but it is now. So it's very typical, so I want you to know you're not alone.
Okay.
Over the last 10 years, the median price of a home in the Seattle area has nearly doubled. Terry is part of a subset of aging baby boomers who up until now have been supporting themselves and living independently. But as costs have crept up, people like Terry are finding that it's harder and harder to make the rent. They're facing the reality of being without a place to live for the first time in their lives. Officials with Seattle's Office of Housing say that Terry's situation is a problem that the city understands and is trying to work on. Denise says that other social workers at senior centers in Seattle are seeing cases similar to Terry's.
And the story is, Jennifer, it's, you know, my rent's going up so much money. I have an income of $900 and I can't afford to live here anymore. And I need low income housing tomorrow. And what we know is low income housing right now, the wait list can be anywhere from 1 year to 5-6 years. And so when you're 80 years old and you need low-income housing tomorrow, and it's just not going to happen.
So when you have those requests, how can you help that person? What happens when that person walks through your door?
Well, one of the first questions I ask is, do you have a car? Because I know that shelter and housing is tough to find, and it's sometimes easier to find a place to park your car and sleep. But again, if you have physical issues, that's not ideal either.
Asking her clients if they have a car to sleep in is sometimes the only helpful advice that Denise has to offer.
So sometimes it's just witnessing their pain, their vulnerability.
Another client Denise is trying to help out is Bob. We're not using his last name because he's still working and he doesn't want his clients or the state to know about his situation. Bob is 80 years old. He's been without stable housing since February. He was evicted from his apartment after he got behind on the rent. He was there when a man came and changed the locks on his door.
I had the clothes on my back and it was cold. It was very cold. And I wasn't wearing a coat. He says, too bad. And I could look in the door, and I could see a couple of coats, I could see work shirts, I could see, I said, let me get just a few things. He says, nope.
I meet Bob in his office. He's behind on the rent here. Like Terry, Bob's income wasn't keeping up with his expenses. Today, Bob spends his Social Security check on a motel room on Highway 99. He says the place is shabby, but clean enough. Every morning, he gets a free muffin for breakfast. A cheap Asian restaurant is where he eats his dinner. On the day we meet, he's run out of money.
I may maybe have two nights left, and then who knows where I'll be. I take full responsibility for some of this. If I had been quicker thinking on my feet, and I'm just not geared that way, and there's a certain amount of adultness that where you have to be.
Terry Parkhurst and Bob have some things in common. Both of them don't have any children, they don't have partners, and they have no close living relatives. They are pretty much alone and are relying on people like Denise to help them navigate a complicated social services system.
Yeah, they're scared. They're so scared. And keep in mind that this generation has kind of grown up with the, pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
I've been self-supporting since I was 6 years old.
I'm going to pay into Social Security and Medicare, and I'm going to be taken care of. It's just not the reality.
I can already feel my health deteriorating from eating, breakfast muffins instead of a decent breakfast, and just the worry of it all.
A few months pass. Terry's situation is more urgent. His apartment building is being sold. Right now, he is in the very uncomfortable position of packing up his belongings without knowing where he's going to end up. Bob is still hanging in there. He's been sneaking into his office at night to sleep. He says if he gets caught, he'll get kicked out. Then he sends me some good news in an email. Bob says he was able to prove to the Veterans Administration that he served in Vietnam. He says this might make him eligible for more help. He knows that he'll never be able to afford a market-rate one-bedroom apartment in Seattle again, nothing like his last place. But for now, he's trying to stay optimistic that pretty soon he'll find housing that is something other than a motel room, his car, or a couch in an office.
That story from Sound Effects' Jennifer Wing. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today on Sound Effect, we're telling stories of being in the wrong place at the wrong time. Richard Hager is an appraiser and a real estate expert, and he often finds himself traveling around the region for work. He tends to stay at brand-name hotels. Nothing fancy, but not flea bags either. But one night, after checking in and taking off his shoes for the evening, Hager began to have this sneaking suspicion that the place he was in was not the place he ought to be.
So I'm in southern Oregon, and I am doing, along the I-5 corridor, I'm doing a series of classes for real estate professionals and law enforcement and the like, and it's on real estate mortgage appraisal fraud and the interaction. And I'm in a hotel, and I check in normally. It's a big chain hotel. It's a two-story tall structure built in probably the late 60s, early 70s, well-maintained, well-known chain motel. It's an upscale. It's not something seedy or anything like that. It does have a kitchenette unit that's in there, and I just can't sleep. And I'm usually pretty easy to get to sleep. It's 2 and 3 in the morning, and I still am not asleep. Get up, I'd watch TV for a few minutes, so, you know, okay, let's shut that down. Okay, let's go take a shower. That's not doing anything. I think I even one time got out and walked around the hotel outside, get some fresh air, which is pretty bizarre in itself, but it was springtime, and I would not go to sleep. I'm trying to figure out why. What's impacting me? And around 4 o'clock, exhaustion starts to get to me, 4, 4:30, and I drop off, but I'm up at 6. So I get a whopping 2 hours of sleep in here because I have to do a class the next day. And I do the class and I swear, you know, everything's moving fast and everything's feeling good and life is okay, but I couldn't sleep the night before, but I'm still doing fine the next day. Going, well, this is unusual. I'm not even a little tired. I want to take a nap or something like that. So I finish my class, we're done. And at noon, I was done, and they said, why don't you stick around? We're going to have a class on drugs. I was like, oh, okay, why do I? And they said, no, you can learn about, you know, meth and coke and all this other stuff that's here, because I do classes for law enforcement and trying to show them how to take out organized crime. And so I'm sitting in their class with a bunch of DEA people that I know, and all of a sudden, I'm hearing the guy, he gets in to start talking about meth. I mean, I've heard of it, you see it on TV, but it's not like I've got a checklist of what it'll do to you. And he's going through, yeah, your first high off of meth is the best, and you won't be able to sleep for days. And then they start talking about how it's cooked. And they said, yeah, they like to cook it in hotels that have a kitchenette in them. That way they can come in, rent it for 1 or 2 days, cook their meth in the sink and on the stove and the like, and all of those chemicals, acetones and the like, get into the carpet, the bedspread, the draperies. It saturates even the sheetrock. And he says, and then the next person who checks into that room, not knowing, they're walking on the floor, they're getting a buzz. And I'm sitting in the back of the room going,
Oh my God. And now all of a sudden I am, you know, you take a shower, you're lying on the bed, I'm absorbing methamphetamines and meth for all of this. And he, the more he describes what it is, the more I'm going, yeah, Dad, that's what I was doing. And I'm sitting in the back and I'm going, how often is that? And then he goes, well, you know, okay, here's the hotel I was staying in. And he goes, oh no, that one's bad. And I went, why do you say that? Oh, we've made multiple arrests there. And I go, okay, how about this hotel up in Eugene? Oh, no, that one. And so now what I would do, my friends, I call them up before I go to different cities, and I go, here's a 4 or 5 choices of a hotel that I'm going to stay at. Bing, bang, and boom. And they go, no, yes. A year and a half later, I was back down in that town, not staying in that hotel. And I'll be darned if they weren't there pulling out all the carpets, all the bedspreads, all the draperies. They were stripping the hotel down. So even the hotel owners finally got to the point of, yeah, we can't be renting these rooms out for $150 a night and getting everybody stoked or something like that. You know, you don't want to be involved in a traffic accident. You don't want to be involved in, and even when you're a kid growing up, some of your friends may have thought, hey, let's get him drunk or something, you know, ha-ha, that sort of thing, and you don't understand. And it was the same thing. I wanted to sleep. I needed to sleep because of what's going on. The fact that I couldn't, I'm angry because of that. Number two, this hotel, they knew that these problems were going on, which is why they had stripped it out. They knew there was a lot of this sort of issue, but they didn't warn any of their guests. That's unfair, and it's just downright wrong. When I'm in the hotel rooms, I try to wear socks or slippers or something so that I'm not in contact with the carpet as much. And, you know, if I've got cloth chairs, I'll toss a towel down in them. If I see kitchen units, I immediately flash back to that night where you couldn't sleep and become a little bit more hesitant about those. And I will go in with alcohol wipes. I know it's not the perfect solution, but I'll clean off the door handles, the doorknobs, the remote control changers, all of those, because I spend a lot of nights in hotels just to make sure. I try to do my best, but unless I have a sampling kit, I'm not going to know if there's meth cooked into the carpet or draperies or something like that. And I've not had any problems since then. And for the most part, you'd assume you'd be safe. But when you start to ask the police and they go, out of the 5 hotels, 3 of them, they'd made a lot of arrests. That's kind of scary.
Richard Hager is an expert on real estate appraisals, lending, and mortgage fraud. He's based on Mercer Island. You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is Picasso. Picasso is a good-sized cat that looks like he's been splashed with white, brown, and black paint. That's how he got his artistic name. Now, Picasso sounds a little agitated, but so would you if you were stuck 40 feet up in a Douglas fir tree outside of Bremerton. Linda Horsley is Picasso's owner.
I have a cat up the tree. Again. Like for the 5th or 6th time.
Our theme today is wrong place, wrong time, and that is Picasso's predicament. Luckily, there is someone who can help out.
Okay, buddy, I'm coming now. Picasso! Oh.
This is Tom Otto. He runs the nonprofit Canopy Cat Rescue, along with his brother-in-law, Sean Sears. Sean's married to Tom's sister. Sean was a mountain climber, and Tom was an arborist, so they'd like to talk shop. Tom taught Sean how to scale trees, and Sean shared his mountaineering skills. They started a tree service business together about 11 years ago, and once in a while, an unusual call would come in.
Every tree climber at some point in their career is probably going to get asked to rescue a cat.
Tom and Sean decided to charge a modest fee for each rescue, $75, but they found that people weren't calling back once they heard that price tag. So, being animal lovers, Tom and Sean started doing rescues for free.
We had a phone conversation where we said, you know, let's not tell any, let's not tell them it's going to cost them anything. Let's just say, you know what, donate if you can, and it'll probably all work out. And it did.
Word got out, calls picked up. One thing led to another, and eventually they got their own show on Animal Planet.
Canopy Cat Rescue.
Hi, is this Sean?
This is Sean. This job always keeps us on call.
How many days has he been up there? Today is the fourth day. Oh.
It was called Treetop Cat Rescue. A camera crew followed them around as they climbed tall trees and brought stranded cats safely back to Earth. The show ran for one season in 2014. Today, Sean is a stay-at-home dad and a full-time cat rescuer. Tom works for the city of Olympia and rescues cats in his off hours. At this rescue near Bremerton, it's just Tom. Picasso's owner, Linda, is eager to get him down.
I have no idea how long he's been up there. He chases rabbits and mice and, you know, whatevers.
Poor Picasso has probably been stuck in this tree for the better part of a week. That is not uncommon. Before responding to a rescue, Tom usually lets the cat hang out in the tree for a few days to see if it comes down on its own. If that hasn't happened after 3 days, then the cat needs some help. But they can't survive up there much longer than you'd think. Tom says he knows one cat that lasted a solid month in a tree.
Now, you might think that's impossible. I thought it was impossible, too.
That cat was up in a big Douglas fir next to a parking lot in Olympia. Some neighbors spotted it and didn't know who the cat belonged to. They called Tom.
So I come out and look, and it's this big Maine Coon. So I set a line in the tree, and I go up, and I get just close enough to read his little name tag on his collar, and it's Winston. As I got close enough to be able to get touch him, he bolted. And he went up like 30 feet. He's probably going to be okay if he's up there for a few more days or whatever. So I told the people, hey, call me back tomorrow and let me know what happens if you see him. Didn't hear anything from him. So I'm like, okay, well, he must have climbed down.
Winston did not, in fact, come down. And Tom got another phone call 25 days later.
So I climb up this time and I'm like, I'm going to get him this time or whatever. I'm going to force him into jumping because he's going to die in the tree.
Tom didn't leave until he got Winston safely into the special net he uses to gently scoop up skittish cats.
He didn't look like the same cat. He was probably a 12 to 16 pound Maine Coon, big cat, and he was probably 8 pounds.
Winston was eventually reunited with his owners, who had thought he was gone for good, and they nursed him back to health. So how did Winston survive so long? Tom has some theories. It rained while he was up there, so there was a little water. He may have dined on ants and was spotted swiping at butterflies.
Maybe he used up 8 of his 9 lives on that one. I don't know, but that's the unbelievable one story that I was even hesitant about posting that on social media because I just figured people were just going to come back and be like, you're lying, you're making it up, and whatever. But that brings me to another quick point. People ask us, like, well, what's the hardest part about doing this? You know, like, is it climbing the tree and getting the cat? And Sean and I really struggle with defending what we do to the naysayers, the cat haters. Why are you wasting your time? Never seen a cat skeleton in a tree. My first instinct is to just be like, read them the riot act. This happens, and oh, by the way, yeah, they can climb down, some of them, but the question isn't whether they can or they can't. It's how long do you let them sit there and suffer? It's an animal welfare thing. It's the humane thing to do is to try to help them.
Well, and that's the other factor, is that it's not just the cat that's suffering. If it's a pet, it's the family that's suffering, right? So how does that figure into what you do and why you do it?
Well, Sean and I, we love cats. We also love helping people. When we're able to hand a cat back to a little youngster, a little girl, boy, or whoever, even an adult, that it really becomes apparent that these are family members.
Over the years, Tom has returned cats to people dealing with the death of a loved one, where the cat was a connection to the person they lost. He's rescued cats for burly macho guys who immediately start bawling as soon as the kitty is safe in their arms again. And he's saved cats for elderly folks who are losing their memories, but who have clearly not forgotten about their beloved pet. Back below the tree where Picasso is stranded, Tom has a long line of rope with a small sandbag at the end. He tosses it into the branches, looking to get a secure hold.
Okay, 10th or 12th time is a charm here. Maybe even the 15th time. Man.
Tom spots some bear scat near the base of the tree. He says cats usually end up in trees because they're being chased by a coyote or a dog, or in Picasso's case, maybe a bear. Once Tom gets his rope placed, he breaks out some serious climbing gear to reach Picasso. He's got a harness and a helmet, there are ropes and carabiners, and there is that net, the mesh bag he uses to carry down the cats. Planning takes almost an hour, but once Tom is in the tree, everything moves quickly.
Picasso! It does smell a little like Picasso pee up here.
He reaches Picasso and tries to coax him in the bag.
I know, buddy. I just want to help you get down. You want to go in the good cat bag?
Tom brings Picasso down to Linda.
Okay.
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 All right.
Come on, baby.
You got him.
Picasso is a little thinner than before. Back at the house, he devours a bowl of food and drinks a lot of water. Linda says he'll go and nap for hours. It's a routine she's familiar with because this is Picasso's fifth or sixth stint in a tree. Watching Tom work and talking to him about what he does, it strikes me that this is one of those purely good acts. Setting aside the cat haters, it seems like there's no downside to this. And that's something that keeps Tom and Sean on the job for free, repeating that act of kindness over and over. They say they perform about 500 rescues a year. That's it for this episode of Sound Effect. The show is produced by Kevin Kniestad, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner, with help from Kari Ploeg. Our executive producer is Matt Martinez, and this week we bid a fond farewell to our ridiculously talented intern, Max Wasserman. Luckily, he's stocked the shelves with awesomeness, so you'll hear plenty from him in coming weeks. You can subscribe to our podcast in all the usual places. That includes Apple Podcasts. Please consider rating and reviewing Sound Effect while you're there and help get the word out. Your feedback is always welcome by email at soundeffect@knkx.org. And one more goodbye, a really hard one. 5 years ago, a little team at what was then KPLU started throwing spaghetti at the wall about launching a new show. At the helm was news director Erin Hennessy. She wanted to call it Renaissance Radio Hour. Luckily, we went with Sound Effect instead. But there was another thing that Erin wrote about our still hypothetical show at the time. Quote, "Every week, our hosts grab you by the hand and say, there's something really cool over here that I want to show you." Now that's something I still think about when we put the show together. Our co-founder, longtime executive producer, and chief morale officer Erin Hennessy is leaving her position this week. She'll still be doing other stuff at KNKX, but on behalf of a team that wouldn't exist if not for her, I'll just say thank you. As for the rest of you, meet you back here next week when our theme is The Collector. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.